Welcome back to our Peace Through Strength podcast, brought to you by the American Security Council Foundation. I'm your host, Joy Vatrebeck, and back with us is our ASCF Senior Fellow, Alan Dowd. Welcome back, Alan.
Always good to talk with you, Joy. Good to be here.
Yes. And we are going to discuss Alan's February article titled Applying the Reagan Doctrine to Today's Challenges. You can read all of Alan's articles on our website at www.ascf.us. Please consider becoming a member of the American Security Council Foundation. It's just $100 for the year, which is less than $10 a month. It includes a yearly paid Substack, as well as our newsletter. So, Alan, without further ado, let's get right into it. On our last podcast, we discussed your article, the first part, on the Reagan Doctrine and how polls showed overwhelming support for supplying military aid to democracies that wanted to defend themselves, as well as strong support for more defense spending. We had some comments from your last our last podcast that Taiwan and Ukraine, I assume they were referring to them, are not allies. So I thought if you could clarify for us, I believe your point that you were trying to make were that these democracies are asking for assistance to fight against totalitarian governments.
Right. Right. Well, your listeners are keen listeners. I don't go back and listen to our interviews. I'm glad other people do, and I'm glad they enjoy them. I'm glad they're pointing out things that need to be clarified. But if I said allies and lumped all those three together, that would, in a technical sense, be incorrect. As your listeners may know or may not know, ally is actually there's a very technical definition for it. The U.S. government in statute defines an ally in a specific way. And actually, oddly, under that definition, you could put all three of those countries in the category of ally, or you could leave them out. Here's the definition. Any nation with which the United States is engaged in a common military effort or with which the United States has entered into a common defensive military alliance. Now, that second part of that clause, that's the ironclad, hardcore ally that comes to mind in a place like, all the 32 members of NATO, 31 plus us, are in that category. The Philippines, South Korea, Australia, Japan, countries of in that group, South Korea, are in that grouping. But then the statute is flexible or elastic enough that you could include, under the first part of the clause, countries like Israel. I think a lot of Americans would think we have a treaty with Israel or a mutual defense treaty with Israel. We don't. That doesn't mean we don't work very closely with them. I think, as you and I have talked before, Israel and the United States are closer and do more when it comes to interoperability, training, and even weapons development than a lot of our treaty allies do. So it kind of underscores the term has multiple meanings, and unless you want to be very technical about it, you could end up creating some confusion, which, of course, I wasn't intending, and you and I weren't intending on to do. One other caveat. I always mention I teach a history course just as an adjunct in college courses. And when the term allies is capitalized, it can mean one of two things. One of the more common uses of allies capitalized is a reference to the World War II allied powers led by the United States, Britain, and the Soviet Union, as well as some other countries. But another way that we see allies capitalized, all official NATO documents refer to the 32 members of the alliance as allies, capital A. So that's a long dissertation in response to some good insights by our listeners.
Yeah, that's actually a good point. I didn't think about the allied powers, but that's a good point.
Yeah, so there's we also know that words have multiple meaning, and I certainly would say that Taiwan, Ukraine, and Israel. We lump those together, by the way, just to refresh the memory of the listeners, because that's what this defense bill that's still languishing in between the House and Senate right now. The Senate's done its job. The House is getting ready to hopefully they lump the three together because all three of them need assistance to defend themselves from attack or deter attack in the case of Taiwan.
Right. Right. Yes. Thank you for clarifying that. And you're right. We were lumping them together to do with the financial assistance. And as you said, some of them can be considered allies, as we would Israel most likely. But we appreciate comments from our listeners and we want comments from our listeners. So thank you for pointing that out. And I think it was a good discussion to have.
Absolutely.
So I'm going to also move on to, you quoted Ronald Reagan in this article, and you said, support for freedom fighters is self-defense and is tied to our own security. So, Alan, in your opinion, how is arming these democracies, such as Ukraine, Taiwan, Israel, tied to our own security?
Let me break them up into each one, sure. Look at each one on its own. Arming, I actually would say, not correcting you, I would say continuing to arm each of them, because we've armed each of them actually for years to varying degrees. We began supporting Israel way back soon after it was born. And in fact, the United States was key to Israel being born and the planting of Israel as a state in 1948. We've supported Taiwan with arms throughout for decades, and Ukraine really since the later, maybe 2016, you know, Russia invaded in 2014. We didn't do anything with lethal aid, and actually President Obama got criticized for that, I think fairly. But then as time wore on, before the end of his administration or his presidency, we began to send arms and trainers to Ukraine, and then that really dialed up under the Trump administration with a lot more arms, a lot more training. And then, of course, when Putin tried to seize the whole country, a whole different kind of aid went into Ukraine. But so let's look at, I think, when it comes to interests, how's it tied to our own security? In Taiwan's case, deterring the PRC from attacking. If we just want to do hold American interest. That means that we're preserving America's eighth largest trading partner, Taiwan. Deterring PRC aggression means that we're preserving the world's largest, most important source of semiconductor chips, which are essential to our economy and the global economy. And deterring the PRC means preventing Xi Jinping from basically seizing or at least holding sway over waterways that move about 60% of global seaborne trade and a quarter of total trade. Those are very much in America's interest, all those things. And then, of course, preserving a sovereign democratic nation, I would submit, is also in our interest. I'll get to that in a moment. On Ukraine,
and I would
helping
just,
the
just stepping back real quickly, Alan, you bring up a good point there, because preserving that ship, those shipping lanes, because as we're seeing with the Houthis over in the Red Sea, is disrupting all of these shipping lanes as well.
Huge disruption. And that's the kind of thing, much worse, much more side effects and much more consequence if we were to see a shooting war on either side of Taiwan, whether it's in the Taiwan Strait or on the other side. The effect on global trade would be enormous. With the Red Sea, it's 15%, you know, and it's costing cargo commercial shipping companies $1 million more apparently to go around basically Africa. A typical ship, all of their insurance rates have skyrocketed, which is all those costs, by the way, as you know and our listeners know. I don't know if the average American thinks about it, as they are focused on things that are close to home, but all of those costs are passed on ultimately to the consumer at some point.
And we probably don't always think about that. You're right. I don't always think about that. But when I go to buy batteries and they've increased like three times, I mean.
That's right. Well, it's because of things like the cost of shipping and the cost of insuring these ships and the cost of moving these products. That's absolutely. And that's a good point. I hadn't really thought of it, but it's a very good point, a chilling point. That what's happening in the Red Sea is a glimpse of just a tiny glimpse of what could happen if a shooting war were to break out over in the South China Sea area. In Ukraine, helping Ukrainians defend themselves This one is, I would say, kind of a is a very much kind of a old fashioned Cold War example. We are weakening by just sending aid to the Ukrainians. They haven't asked for any American troops, by the way. You know, I know your listeners know this, but I don't think the average American knows that there aren't American troops on the ground there. But we're weakening one of our chief adversaries, literally grinding down the Russian military, which is commanded by a regime, by a person that openly wants to reconstitute the Russian Empire. And he defines the Russian Empire as extending deep into Central Europe, countries including Poland, the Baltic countries, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania. These countries are members of NATO, which means if Putin were to try to do and replicate what he's done in Ukraine there, we'd be looking at a war. So it makes sense, a strategic sense, national interest sense, to help Ukrainians fight him there. They want to defend themselves. All they want to echo Churchill, just give us the tools, we'll fight the war. That's what they're asking. And in doing so, they're weakening Putin. They're blunting Putin. And they're forcing Russia to expend finite resources there. And again, it's at a fraction of the cost of our defense budget. And again, preserving a sovereign democratic nation is in our national interest. And oh, by the way, just going back to some of the things we mentioned about, say, semiconductors and such in Taiwan, what we've learned, you know, Americans didn't know that in this just-in-time globalized free trade economy that has been built up over the last 40 years or so, Ukraine was a key supplier in the last 25 years or so of a whole range of things that the rest of the world needs, including agriculture products, including basic cereals, corn and other things, including products that help agriculture thrive, like fertilizers, chemicals, et cetera. Those have been taken out off of the global market, and that's affecting things as well. So there's first order and then second order national interest in Ukraine. And you know, on Ukraine, since we you and I work with and for a Reagan Knight organization, an organization that believes in and embraces Reagan's philosophy. Reagan had no qualms, moral at all, about arming anti-Kremlin movements and pro-democracy movements in Eastern Europe, in Afghanistan, in Central America, in Africa. He had no qualms about arming these anti-Kremlin pro-democracy movements because he knew that would weaken the Soviet Union. And by the way, I say anti-Kremlin and pro-democracy on purpose. Some anti-Kremlin movements were not very pro-democratic. they were not pro-freedom movement. They were. It was the right thing to do. Helping them was the right thing to do because it weakened the evil empire. Mm-hmm. Today, helping Ukraine, the good thing we have in Ukraine's case is it's an anti-Kremlin and pro-democracy effort. So there's it should be an easier case to make, it seems to me. And I'm there's zero doubt in my mind that Reagan would be on the forefront if he had been elected in 2020 or if he had been president in 2014 when Putin did his annexation of Crimea. He'd be on the forefront of making the case to arm Ukraine and getting Ukraine what it needs to defend itself and to secure what it defines as victory because they're fighting for their own freedom. So finally, then we go to Israel. Israel, I think supporting Israel is in the national interest for a strategic region like the Middle East with strategic resources. It's important for that region not to be under the sway of an Iranian vassal or an Iranian proxy, more terrorist groups. All of Iran's proxies are terrorist groups. And so that's important. You know, Israel, as we've seen, sits on the Mediterranean and the shores of the Red Sea. These are vital waterways, and having a democratic ally in Israel helps us have a toehold there and a dependable toehold. You know, we have other partners in that region, that are not so dependable sometimes. And it's one of the main reasons they don't share our values. It's difficult for the United States, for an American president, no matter who it is, if you're a Obama person or a Bush person, a Biden person or a Trump person or none of the above, it's hard for a president in a democracy with a conscience to make deals with some of these countries in the Middle East. And that's hard. It's part of statecraft. It's a lot easier to do if you didn't have a conscience. It's a lot easier for the Chinese or the Russians to make deals with these some of these regimes. But it's just difficult to do that for a country where you have people who believe in, thankfully, human rights. In the case of Israel, it's a country that is a strong, vibrant, fractious democracy that shares our values, and that's very important. And as we talked at the top of the show, we cooperate with them on the full range of things, weapons development, training. We have a base there, we work together in overt and very many covert ways to fight our common enemy.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for pointing that out. And even going back to what you were saying with Ukraine, and Reagan would be on the front lines of fighting this because he was fighting anti-communism, the Cold War. I mean, right. ASCF's history was based on anti-communism, fighting communism in the United States and the Cold War, and President Reagan was on board with our Peace Through Strength coalition.
Right.
So in your last article, you also stated that there was strong support among the American public to increase defense spending, which, I said, I was very surprised to learn some of these numbers were very good. Better than I had thought as far as the public was concerned. And you make the case for spending more money on our defense to deter totalitarian governments, as we discussed, and you went through all the governments that are out there and the challenges they're presenting so that we don't escalate into a shooting war, as we discussed.
That's right. Well, that, I think, shows that there's an innate wisdom, I think, among the American people. The poll that I cited in that article, 77% of the country thinks we need to increase defense spending. I think that's because they're seeing what's happening around the world. And they have a sense that they do connect what has happened to two democracies attacked in an unprovoked way, Ukraine and Israel. And then they see Taiwan staring down the barrel of this behemoth that brutalizes its own people, that is an irresponsible member of the international community. And that is just in the midst of a massive, unprecedented military buildup. And again, is unprovoked. There's no one that's trying to seize or threaten Chinese territory. You know, the Chinese, I hope presidents, when they meet with their counterparts in China, remind them that Taiwan has never been ruled by the Chinese Communist Party. So it's a myth manufactured by the PRC that they will reunify. Taiwan, sure, has been part of mainland China, but never part of the PRC. So I think that the American people supporting an increase in defense is a sign that there's wisdom there. I hope that their representatives in Congress and in the White House see this as an opportunity to start, and it's not easy, but to start a stair step move toward increased defense spending in a sustained way, in a rational way, and a stair step. I use the word stair step because you can't really just pour immediately the kinds of resources we need into the Pentagon right away. We're talking about, you know, to get to what I think and what other experts think we need, which is we're in a kind of Cold War 2.0. Well, then we need Cold War levels of defense spending that means we need to get up toward 5%. We're at 3.1 right now. So you're talking about 200 or 300 billion more dollars annually to get us up toward that level. And the political will is there among the American people. So it's time for the lawmakers to move forward with it. And I hope they do.
Yes, and as you point that out in your article, and I thought that was good. And you also said, and I'll a quote from Reagan, that Reagan observed national security as government's first responsibility. And I think a lot of people, most people would agree that today our government has become too big with too many programs.
That's right.
And I think it was just national security. It was very basic, national security, infrastructure, you know, just very basic things, and we've gotten very big today. So question, do you believe President Reagan would cut some programs like the UNRWA, which I'm glad to see we have stopped at this point, and maybe some other subsidies in order to increase defense spending?
Well, as you so often do, Joy, you hit the nail on the head. The reason that the lawmakers, and we can include, you know, the White House lawmakers and the law, the White House who put the law into force, aren't able to move ahead with the immediate and the big increases in defense that we need is because of spending that has been out of control on other programs. You know, I often say to folks that I speak with that, you know, defense spending is not to blame for the country's fiscal challenges. It's just not. We could shut the Pentagon down, end the Department of Defense, turn the Pentagon into a mega mall. We'd still have a deficit, and it wouldn't put a dent into the national debt. That's how big the problem is. Mm-hmm. And that's just, again, a matter of political will. And then you have to pivot to solutions like you did, Joy. President Reagan certainly would pursue cuts for the good of the national defense to ensure that government can do its primary responsibility, which is protect the territory, people, and interests of the United States. That's becoming increasingly hard to do as domestic programs and interest on the debt squeeze out the ability of lawmakers to put money into vital programs like defense. So I think Reagan would. I think the history shows that he would have done that. Of course, the old saying, you have to have a dance partner. You know, if we have a, you know, it doesn't seem President Biden would do that in a second term. President Trump didn't show, by the way, if he's elected, he didn't show any proclivity or signs that he would make hard decisions or propose hard cuts either. So if we were get to a point where that's going to happen, maybe it has to come from Congress. Maybe Congress should create a commission that has the force of law behind it that can propose things that are cuts to domestic spending. You and I both know about the Base Realignment and Closure Committee. No matter what anybody thinks about the BRAC process, it was very effective at helping all of Congress and then more than one president join arms and say, okay, we're biting the bullet together and we're going to make necessary cuts on these facilities. You could have the similar idea with domestic programs. That you have a commission appointed, and it's the commission makes recommendations, dispassionate recommendations about what needs to be cut, what changes need to be made, what reforms need to be made to free up resources for the Pentagon and to get the spending on domestic programs under control. But let's be honest, we haven't had really such an effort really since the 1990s, when a Republican Congress and a Democratic president worked together to control spending. That has not happened. That's a long time. You know, we're looking at a quarter century ago, and the spending has just gone off the rails since then.
That's a good point, because we're in divisive times, too. I mean, we do have bipartisan support on things like the CCP, but...
That's right, and that's a great thing. And that, by the way, that's good that you mentioned that. That shows that there are things we can rally around. And national security, 77% support. You and I know this. We're students of what happens in America. 77% of Americans don't agree on anything. But 77% of Americans agree that we need to spend more on defense. Well over, I think it's in the 70s or low 60s or high 60s, think the PRC is a threat. You know, I recognize that as a threat. Those are things we can build on. By the way, you mentioned the UNRWA and the awful things that it's been caught, yes, implicated in the Gaza territory, and whether Reagan would support cutting it. I think he would. you know, but if we didn't spend any money at all on NRWA, it wouldn't free up a whole bunch of resources. You know, we spent $7 billion on that program since 1950. Last year, I think we spent a little over $340 million with an M. Mm. That's a lot of money. Right. But as you know, relative to the defense budget, that's really a kick in the, you know, just a drop in the bucket. There's nothing there. If we need $200 billion or more annually, and I would be of the view, I wouldn't fund that if I was a member of Congress. I'd vote against that. If I was an advisor to the president, I'd say that'd be top of the list to cut, given what they've been implicated in. These are literally terrorists who are working for that organization, literally. So.
Right. So thankfully we're stopping that bleed at this moment. But yeah, I just use that as an example, as one thing. I mean, and I'm sure we can find numerous places to cut spending. So
there are, but we have to, everyone has to recognize that there'll be something that such an effort, if we were to go down the effort of having a commission to find a way to control spending, to cut spending, that there'll be pain to that, you know. There was a great effort. It didn't have the force of law behind it, but it was known as the Simpson-Bowles Commission in the 2009-2010 period that proposed some very effective, very clear, very doable reforms that both sides could agree on. And there was just not any follow-through from the president at the time. And that's too bad. It was a bipartisan effort, but it wasn't a congressional commission, so it didn't have a force of law behind the way some other commissions have that could really put teeth into it.
Well, and like you said, there has to be the political will there.
That's right.
And you bring up a good point, and I agree. There is definitely going to be some pain if we cut in certain areas. I mean, obviously, there's Social Security. It takes up a big, huge chunk. Healthcare. There's a lot of issues that the American people would feel.
No doubt about it. And that pain has to be put in perspective of, or in context of, the alternative could be having to, because we haven't put money into deterrent military strength, having to fight a war that really would make everything else pale in comparison. And not a war that would be contained over there the way we fought most of the wars. Certainly all the wars that in our lifetime, you're in my lifetime, Joy, but one that would touch our shores in a different way, even than 9/11 did.
Mm. Yeah, and that was a lot of spending there, and a lot of lives, though, what 20 years we've spent, Afghanistan and Iraq. So.
That's right. But these are, they're doable, they just take will, and hopefully the next Congress will have that will. Hopefully this Congress finishes out this year can rise to the occasion and find some resources for Taiwan, Ukraine, and Israel, whether you call them allies or partners or friends or all the above. They are, as you said, they're fighting for their freedom. That's right. Their democracy is fighting for their freedom.
Well, thank you, Alan. I appreciate your time today and your article.
Thank you, Joy. Always good to talk with you.
And to our listeners, again, you can read Alan's entire article at our website, www.ascf.us. Again, we appreciate your comments as it leads to good discussion, so please feel free to comment on this podcast. And you can find us on YouTube, Rumble, on our Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And we hope you join us again next time for Peace Through Strength podcast.